Hello and welcome. I'm Vincent McCorry. Welcome to VOA Presents. U.S. President Barack Obama is in South Africa, the second leg of his three-nation African tour. This is his first visit to sub-Saharan Africa since a short visit to Ghana 4 years ago. On his week-long visit, the president says he wants to develop ties with the continent based on trade and partnership instead of aid and assistance. Today, Mr. Obama is participating in a town hall meeting with young African leaders at the University of Johannesburg, Soweto campus. They will be joined by young leaders joining remotely from Uganda, Nigeria, and Kenya. They're expected to discuss the challenges facing sub-Saharan Africa and the hopes and dreams of the continent's next generation of leaders. The president is also expected to announce a new initiative to work more closely with young leaders. Joining me to discuss the president's trip and today's town hall is Emira Woods, co-director of Foreign Policy in Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies here in Washington. Welcome.
Great to be with you as always.
Thank you very much. Now, just tell me, what's your assessment of the president's visit up to this point?
Well,
has it achieved?
Well, I think in terms of achievements, you would have to say very little to date, but still a lot of media attention around Africa globally. I think the world media is paying attention to the president as he travels. I think it's really interesting to see how from Senegal to now South Africa, doesn't matter where he is, really the condition of Nelson Mandela is overshadowing much of the trip.
Exactly. Now, the president, as we mentioned at the top, has said that he wants to form strong ties with the continent based on trade, business partnership, rather than aid. How has that been playing out up to this point?
Well, I think overall throughout the continent, there's a bit of concern that the U.S. has not necessarily done its share in terms of development. That really the U.S. has focused a lot on security sector throughout the continent. And so, you know, you saw yesterday in South Africa, young people leading a demonstration, no Obama, you know, essentially talking about the U.S. overemphasis on this search for terrorists, the so-called war on terror, and really critiquing that. So I think that for many on the continent, there's a bit of an imbalance that needs to be shifted in a different direction, in a direction that helps to support Africa's dramatic economic rise, but to make sure that the economic growth actually improves the conditions of the majority of the people, some say the 99% on the continent. You know, it doesn't necessarily only benefit a narrow elite and a very small few slice of the population, but has a broad-based impact throughout the economy, throughout the countries, throughout the continent.
Yes. In fact, earlier today, also in South Africa, the president said that he's not really concerned or scared about the investment by other countries, including China, that actually the more the merrier on the continent. Do you think that is the best approach?
Without a doubt, there's a lot of focus on this trip, especially in the U.S. media, on China. It's almost as if, you know, China is replacing the Soviet Union as the other, you know, creating the sense of a bipolar world. But what we realize, Vincent, and I think Africans recognize this best, is that this is now a multipolar world. You have a lot of economic actors. You know, it is Brazil, it's India, it's Russia, these BRICS, right? Yeah. All of these newly emerging countries are key actors on the geopolitical stage. They're also key actors in Africa's economic future. And so it's not just looking at the U.S. or just looking at China. It will take a broad-based efforts, but really driven by Africans, both those on the continent and those in the diaspora, setting back their remittances. Because for sure, remittances outstrip both aid and trade, and we cannot forget that.
Yes. And we have a lot more to discuss. But right now, let's mention that today's town hall takes place on the Soweto campus of the University of Johannesburg. Mary Alice Salinas takes a look at Soweto's history and the promise it holds today.
The images from a 1976 student uprising in the township of Soweto are still searing. Apartheid police firing at and beating back black students rebelling against a deliberately racist educational system imposed by the powerful apartheid government. South African ambassador to the U.S., Ibrahim Rasool, says this is when Soweto rose to the global stage and gave birth to a long and difficult, but ultimately successful, struggle to end government-mandated racial segregation.
In a way, it has come to embody the symbol of resistance, that you don't have to accept injustice and wrong.
Much like the civil rights movement in the United States in the 1960s.
The civil rights leaders said, you know, we must be free at home, but we also must defend the right of those abroad to be free as well, especially those in Southern Africa.
Carson says a visit to Soweto by the first black U.S. president sends an especially powerful message to all those who struggled against racial discrimination.
It is a tribute to all of those who live there and who fought against apartheid, sacrifice their lives, sacrifice their community, their development in order to change the system.
Soweto is no longer the collection of shanty towns it was when South Africa's first black president, Nelson Mandela, took office in 1994. It is now a center for tourism, culture, and a growing middle class.
There is this creativity, there is this dynamism, there is this growth that is taking place.
Rasool acknowledges there are still many challenges, including poverty, unemployment, and housing problems in Soweto. But he notes there is a renewed hope, especially among young people who are pushing ahead with astounding speed.
Soweto has almost moved directly from the drum to the cell phone without too many fixed lines in between. In much the same way, it is going from counting on our fingers in Soweto to using the tablets and iPads and all of those kind of modern technology, no personal computers in between. I think that this is the energy that I think you must see.
Rasool says Soweto today offers a window to a new Africa and symbolizes not only resistance, but resilience. Mary Alice Salinas, VOA News, Washington.
Well, VOA's senior White House correspondent Dan Robinson has been traveling with the president and joins us now from Johannesburg. Hey, Dan, welcome.
Yes, thank you. And earlier today, President Obama held talks with President Jacob Zuma. Mr. Obama has just now arrived in Soweto for that joint town hall with African youth. But speaking earlier at a news conference, he spoke warmly about Nelson Mandela.
Our thoughts and those of Americans and people all around the world are with Nelson Mandela and his family and all of South Africans. The struggle here against apartheid for freedom, Madiba's moral courage, this country's historic transition to a free and democratic nation, has been a personal inspiration to me. It has been an inspiration to the world, and it continues to be.
Well, thank you so much. And Mr. Obama went on to talk about trade and investment, saying the United States wants greater trade with Africa.
I'm here in Africa because I think the United States needs to engage in a continent full of promise and possibility. I think it's good for the United States, regardless of what others do. I actually welcome the attention that Africa is receiving from countries like China and Brazil and India and Turkey. Because, number one, the more interest they show in Africa, the more tools we have and mechanisms we have to further incorporate Africa into the global economy, which has the potential of creating jobs and businesses and opportunity. So I don't feel threatened by it. I think it's a good thing.
We have seen some pockets of it, but...
Well,
yeah.
Dan, thank you very much for sharing that with us. One thing, and I want to flip this a little bit to the question of Nelson Mandela's health. Everybody was wondering, will the president visit Mandela, or at least the Mandela family? What has happened today?
Well, that has just taken place, and in fact, the president issued a written statement saying he had the privilege of meeting with members of the Mandela family. And a paraphrase for you, he said he expressed his hope that Madiba draws peace and comfort from the time he is spending with loved ones, and expressed his heartfelt support for the entire family working through this difficult time. President said he also reaffirmed the profound impact, rather, that his legacy has had in building a free South Africa and in inspiring people around the world, including the president, President Obama. He said that's a legacy that we must all honor in our own lives, including this July on Mandela Day. He also said that Madiba and his family remain in our thoughts and prayers.
Thanks a lot, Dan. We hope to join you again later on after the town hall. That's viewers Daniel Robinson reporting from Johannesburg, and we thank him so much for joining us. Emira, coming back here to studio, if I may take you back to President Obama's comment on the investment in Africa, on China and other players in Africa. The question that sometimes people want to ask is there more than we are seeing on the continent? I mean, is the U.S. investing more than people appreciate? Or in terms of the real numbers, you feel like the U.S. has actually been trumped?
Well, I think we have to understand that U.S. investment has been there. It's, you know, it's been for decades a constant, particularly in oil, gas, and mining. Those key sectors make up about 90% of U.S. trade with the continent. And so, you know, that trade has expanded, not only with the U.S. and China, but many other countries, as was noted in the president's statement. I think the issue is, to what extent can there be a shift in economic engagement that actually helps to build manufacturing, not just extract the resources, put them on a ship, and send them to U.S.
Europe? And that's why the president cautioned that actually the African nations have to be very careful. They have to be worried of these investors coming, taking African resources without questioning how are we benefiting. Can you say that perhaps the U.S. is more cautious and tries as much as possible to benefit the Africans than perhaps other investors like China?
No, I think the U.S., China, Europe, they're all cut from the same cloth, Vincent, without a doubt. They are interested in maximizing their profits, right? I think the difference, let's say, with China is also investing in infrastructure, building roads and stadiums and hospitals, concrete issues in addition to economic trade, yeah. Right? So that there's a qualitative difference there when people can see an infrastructural development. And, you know, I think clearly there needs to be a recognition that you have multinational corporations, wherever they're based, that are interested in their own gain, profit.
I guess then it behoves
above all
on,
else.
It behoves
and you
on
need,
the, yeah.
You need attention to environmental impact. You need attention to labor rights. You need attention to how to add value to the resources of Africa, right? So it's manufacturing. It's creating an infrastructure that will create jobs that will be good quality jobs to help people provide a decent living, to put food on the table, to feed their children, send their children to school, so all those building blocks of healthy society.
I guess this it behoves on the governments of Africa to make sure that they're getting value for the investments
well,
and the continent.
Without a doubt, but part of the problem is there's been a massive outflow of resources, capital flight from the continent. Yeah. So you have restrictions often caused by the World Bank IMF policy that say get rid of capital controls. Don't create any barriers to capital leaving, to monies leaving your shores and going to tax havens in the Cayman Islands or elsewhere.
Wow.
So you need to actually create an incentive where people are leaving the resources in the country so that they can benefit the people of that country.
Strong policies on the part of the continent, on the part of the African countries. But let's go back to a little bit of history of American presidents visiting Africa. Mr. Obama's focus on Africa is following in the footsteps of recent U.S. presidents. VOA's Meredith Beal has more.
Mr. Obama's trip to Africa is the latest in a list of visits by American presidents going back 70 years. Alan Lichtman is a presidential historian and professor at American University.
So by going to Africa, presidents demonstrate that Africa is not forgotten, that the African people and the African nations are important to the American people and to American policymakers.
While many presidential visits have focused on humanitarian aid, President Obama is focusing on trade, investment, and democracy. Jennifer Cook of the Center for Strategic and International Studies says Mr. Obama is looking to the future.
Moving beyond some of that long-time commitment on humanitarian issues to a much more kind of upbeat and formal, forward-looking engagement that a lot of young people in Africa are looking for.
President Franklin Roosevelt made trips to North Africa during World War II to meet with allies, including British Prime Minister Winston Churchill. In 1943, the leaders met in Casablanca and later that year in Cairo to discuss strategy for the wars in Europe and the Pacific. President Jimmy Carter visited Nigeria and Liberia in 1978.
Thank you all.
As a former president, Mr. Carter has made many trips to Africa, focusing on diseases such as river blindness and malaria. The Carter Center's campaign to eliminate guinea worm disease is hailed as a major success.
And we believe that in the next two or three years, we'll have zero cases of guinea worm in Sudan.
Former presidents like Bill Clinton used their foundations to sponsor humanitarian projects in Africa. Again, Professor Alan Lichtman.
So you can actually immediately and directly see the results of your initiatives in Africa. That's more difficult in other parts of the world.
2, 3.
Healthcare experts say George W. Bush's initiative to fight HIV and AIDS in Africa has saved millions of lives. Since leaving office, Mr. Bush and his wife, Laura, have remained active in African health issues.
The Bush Center is proud, along with our partners, to dedicate ourselves to saving as many lives as we possibly can.
Helping people in Africa resonates in a positive way at home. Analyst Jennifer Cook.
It's not only the presidents, it's the U.S. public and U.S. Congress, I think, that sees itself as doing those kinds of things in the world, kind of a moral force for good.
And that is a legacy many leaders seek. Meredith Buell, VOA News, Washington.
Now, Amira, would you say that President Obama has had this challenge of having to come after President George W. Bush, who kind of really became very prominent, very present on the continent, not only with the number of countries he visited, but also the programs he pushed, whether it is HIV and PEPFAR funding and other programs like AGOA and the rest?
Well, I think the real issue for President Obama is that there was such high expectations that this son of Africa, I mean, he's revered, he was revered, especially as the campaign took off, as really the first, with his father coming from Kenya, you know, the first to actually have the highest seat in the land, in the White House. And so there were high expectations of a real opportunity to shift U.S. engagement with Africa to a more positive relationship.
I mean, would you say it appeared to be a kind of a lesser, sharper pointed during his tenure than during his predecessors?
Well, I think overall what we've seen is that, the first term, there was still a continuation. It was almost more of the same. You had, under the Bush administration, this push to militarize U.S. engagement with Africa in 2008, the establishment of the U.S.-Africa Command. And, you had then under President Obama more of the same, a continuation of a more, security-focused, security sector reform, but really a more militarized engagement with the continent.
Thank you very much. And now we want to take you over to South Africa.
But there's absolutely
and we have the event there in Soweto at the Johannesburg University Soweto campus. Join in.
Impact on the African continent. They have brought hope in Africa and also began the process of restoring pride and dignity in the African people. Now, as I speak to you, and as you all know, President Nelson Mandela is lying in hospital, critically ill. The euphoria that engulfed this continent when President Obama was elected is fading. But in this room, look around you, is Africa's brand new hope. These young people are doing amazing things in their communities. They have already been identified as leaders, and leaders who are committed to serving others and not themselves. Exactly 37 years ago this month, young school children here in Soweto braved apartheid bullets fighting for freedom. It's no coincidence that a new generation of young people is here today. And like the 76th generation, they refuse to conform, but are inspired to transform their world. When President Obama launched the Young African Leaders Initiative in 2010, he described them as the Africa that is overlooked. Well, at this moment, the world can see and hear you. President Obama will come here, address you, and then engage you. We will take a question here in South Africa before we cross to Kenya, Uganda, and then Lagos, Nigeria. When the president selects you, please be proud. Introduce yourselves and ask a short, sharp, smart question. As a fellow African, I really want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for keeping hope alive in Africa. Please join me in welcoming on stage the 44th President of the United States of America, Barack Obama.
Wonderful to be back in South Africa. Everybody have a seat. Everybody have a seat. Relax. Yeah, I'm excited too. It is wonderful to be here with all these extraordinary young people, young people from across this magnificent country, but also from all across the continent. And I want to give special thanks and special welcome to those who are watching from Nigeria and Uganda and Kenya, a country obviously very close to my heart. You know, when I travel around the world, this is one of my favorite things to do, meeting and talking with young men and women like you. And our format today, this town hall, is a long-standing tradition in America. And I get asked all sorts of things. I remember one event, a person asked a question that's often on a lot of people's minds when I show up. Where's Michelle? Sometimes people ask me, you seem to have gotten so old since you were elected. What happened? So this format can be a little humbling, but it energizes me. Because it gives me a chance to hear from you directly, what you're thinking, what you care about, what your vision is. And I'm making this trip to Africa because I believe this is a region on the move. Even as this continent faces great challenges, and they are great, and we can't paper over them or pretend that those challenges don't exist. Even as too many Africans still endure tremendous hardship and great injustice, there is, as the song says, a new Africa, more prosperous, more confident, taking its place on the world stage. And one of the reasons is because of your generation. And it's fitting that we've gathered here, in Joburg, in Soweto, because here we learn that history is in our hands. Not far from here, in Orlando West, two young men came of age who would transform this nation and inspire the world. Nelson Mandela and Desmond Tutu. And President Mandela once said that during all those years in that cell, it was his home here in Soweto, that small red brick house that was what he called the center point of my world. And obviously, he's on our minds today. And we join the people of the world in sending our prayers to Madiba and his family because he still inspires us all. Now, not far from here, on a June morning, young students gathered in peaceful protest for the right to be taught in their own language, for the right to be treated like human beings. And after all the police bullets, after the smoke cleared, the world was shocked by that image, protesters holding the body of a young boy, Hector Peterson. And what a powerful tribute it is to Hector's sacrifice and to all who struggled that we can gather here today in a free South Africa, at a university that serves all South Africans. And I know the story of Soweto inspires you in your lives, but keep in mind it inspired me too. The uprising here helped open my mind to a broader world and to our responsibilities to choose between fairness and injustice, between right and wrong. And as a senator, during my first visit to South Africa, I was able to go to Hector Peterson's memorial and pay tribute to an African boy who moved the world. And humbled by the sacrifices of all who've gone before us, so that we can stand here as free men and women, I'm honored to return to Soweto now as President of the United States of America. Now, tomorrow I'll be down in Cape Town at the University of Cape Town, and I'll speak about the future that we can build together, Africans and Americans. And that's where Robert Kennedy delivered his eloquent address to another generation of young people. The challenges of our world, he said, demand the qualities of youth. Not a time in life, but a state of mind, a temper of the will, a quality of the imagination, a predominance of courage over timidity, of the appetite for adventure over the love of ease. That's what young people are. That's the spirit of youth. And it's still true. And that's why 3 years ago I launched a new effort to make sure we're tapping those qualities of youth, the imagination, the courage, the yes we can attitude of young Africans like you. It's our Young African Leaders Initiative, and I kicked it off by welcoming young men and women from across Africa to the White House, and we had a town hall similar to this one. I think some of you were there, in fact. And since then, we've helped empower young people across this continent with new skills in entrepreneurship and leadership, and new partnerships in education and health and technology. You know, Michelle came here to Soweto for a forum with some inspiring young women. And she's here today in Josie, meeting with students who... Did I say that right? Meeting with students who, like you, are going to determine the future of your countries. So today, I'm proud to announce a significant expansion of this initiative. We're launching a new program that's going to give thousands of promising young Africans, like you, the opportunity to come to the United States and develop your skills at some of our best colleges and universities. It's called the Washington Fellowship for Young African Leaders. And I hope all of you apply, because we're joining with our top schools, public and private. We'll focus on civic leadership and public administration and business and entrepreneurship, the skills you need to serve your communities and start and grow businesses and run effective ministries. And you'll interact with Americans from all walks of life, because our citizens, especially our young people, can learn from you too. You'll meet with leaders in business and nonprofits and government, including me. And I look forward to welcoming you at a summit that I'll host in Washington, because I want to hear directly from you, your hopes, your dreams, what we can achieve together. And your time in America will be just the beginning. When you come back home, new grants will help you turn your ideas into new businesses and new nonprofits. And we're going to partner with American companies here in Africa to provide internships and mentoring and job opportunities to help you grow into the next generation of business leaders. We're going to partner with your governments and regional organizations here in Africa and foundations and civil society to amplify your voices as you stand up for democracy and equality. And with the connections you make as a Washington Fellow, you'll have something else for the rest of your life, and that is a network of Africans and Americans ready to collaborate on the future that you want to build. So this won't be the most expensive program that we have, but I actually believe this is going to end up being one of the most important. And it's important to me personally, because it's a great way for me to show my faith and confidence in all of you. I believe in you, and I intend to make this a lasting part of our engagement with Africa beyond my presidency for years to come. We want to empower entrepreneurs like Fred Swaniker. Where's Fred? He's from Ghana. Where is he?
President Obama holding a town hall with the young African leaders in Soweto, South Africa.
So, Fred's got a fan club over here. Fred helped to start a biotech company and now uses his expertise to help other young Africans develop their leadership skills so that they can come back and put those skills to use, serving their communities, starting businesses, creating jobs. So thank you, Fred, for the great work that you're doing. We want to empower citizens like Khadija Patel. Where's Khadija? Where's Khadija? So, Khadija is a fearless journalist here in South Africa. She's reported on Sudan and Mali and the Democratic Republic of Congo. She's exposed the roots of conflict. She's challenged leaders as a voice for peace and justice. So we're very proud of the work that you do, Khadija. Thank you. We want to empower advocates like Jacob Jabari. Where's Jacob? Right here. So, here in South Africa, Jacob decided he was not going to hide the fact that he was HIV positive. He embraced it. He became a counselor. He helps guide others, because he says the key to saving lives and slowing the spread of AIDS is an honest approach, and that takes great courage. Thank you, Jacob. And we want to empower women like Lebu Bogipane. Lebu. You know, growing up, Lebu endured domestic abuse and violence, which led to homelessness and hunger. Over many years, she didn't simply rebuild her own life. She built a crisis center here in South Africa that's helped thousands of women and children escape abuse as well. What a great legacy. Thank you. So building the future that you seek, realizing the vision that you have, not just for your own countries, but for the world, it will not be easy. It will not be easy. But as you go forward, I want you to think of the man who's in our prayers today. Think about 27 years in prison. Think about the hardships and the struggles and being away from family and friends. Reflecting on his years in prison, Nelson Mandela wrote that there were dark moments that tested his faith in humanity, but he refused to give up. And he said, "I'm fundamentally an optimist. Whether it comes from nature or nurture, I cannot say. Part of being optimistic is keeping one's head pointed towards the sun, one's feet moving forward. So in your lives, there will be time to test your faith. But no matter how old you grow, I say to all of you today, don't lose those qualities of youth, your imagination, your optimism, your idealism. Because the future of this continent is in your hands. And if you keep your head pointed towards the sun and you keep your feet moving forward, I promise you will have no better friend and partner than the United States of America. Thank you very much, everybody. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. So now I get to do what I really want to do, which is to hear from you. So why don't we open up for questions, and I understand that we've got somebody from South Africa here, perhaps.
Yes, the plan is to get somebody here in Soweto before we move across to other parts of the continent.
Okay.
The choice is yours, Mr. President.
This is a good-looking group. Let me I'm going to call on this young lady right here. Introduce yourself.
Good afternoon, President Obama. My name is Musa. I'm an attorney, and I'm passionate about telecoms in Africa. My question is, the African Growth and Opportunities Act, the term expires in 2015, and I understand that there's a bill which provides for an extension to 2019. Do you think this bill will be passed? And if it isn't passed, what do you think the impact will be on small states in Africa that are benefiting, such as Lesotho and Togo?
It's a great question. What kind of law are you practicing?
Oh, right now I actually do cross-border African work.
Excellent.
Yeah, M&A work.
Fantastic. For those of you who are not as familiar with it, the program we call AGOA is basically a trade arrangement that allows probably 95% of goods from Africa to come into the United States without tariffs, duty-free. And as a consequence, it obviously gives African exports a greater advantage. And the whole idea is that, you know, historically, if you look at the relationship between Africa and the rest of the global market, dating back to colonial days, the idea was somehow that raw materials get sent somewhere else, they get produced somewhere else or refined somewhere else. Sometimes they're sold back to Africa, but the jobs, the value, the profits are all someplace else. And we graduated from those colonial times to the idea of aid, which continues to be critically important. There are parts of Africa where right now people just need food, or right now people just need medicine. And it is the obligation of wealthier nations to help deliver that food or that medicine. But everywhere I go in Africa, what's very clear is people want to break out of a dependency trap. The idea is not that Africa somehow should be the ward of some other country. What we need is an Africa that is building, manufacturing, creating value, inventing, and then sending those products around the world and receiving products in return in fair terms of trade. And if we do that, then there's no reason why Africa cannot succeed. So part of what I'm trying to highlight during this trip is the enormous opportunities for an Africa that is intimately integrated into the world market. I want small and medium-sized businesses and entrepreneurs and startups here in Africa to see their potential not just in the local market, but to be able to sell goods and services all around the world, and to bring those profits back to Africa and reinvest in Africa and hire Africans. And so as part of that, we want to make sure that the United States is a critical trading partner. And by the way, we're not doing it out of charity. We're doing it because if Africa is doing well, then now we've got a market of people who will want to buy more iPads and Boeing airplanes and all the good stuff that we sell, right? And Africa, by the way, is the youngest continent, which means that demographically, this is going to be a larger and larger share of the world market. So specifically in terms of AGOA, you're right. The current AGOA structure expires in 2015. It is my hope that we get it renewed. Now, what I mentioned to President Zuma today, and I said this at a press conference, is that we will have to engage in some negotiations to find ways to both improve what we're currently doing, but also to reflect on the fact that South Africa is becoming more and more successful, and that U.S. businesses, in order for me to get it through Congress in the United States, U.S. businesses have to feel as if they're getting a level playing field relative to, for example, some of the European companies who are able to operate here, because there's a free trade agreement between Europe and the United States. But I'm confident that with good negotiations that we should be able to get it done. The broader point I want to make, though, is that the future is going to be in creating value here in Africa and making sure then that, like, Southeast Asia and China and Turkey and all these other places around the world, that everybody is starting to see the benefits of global trade patterns. And Africa cannot just be a source of raw materials for somebody else. It has to be a source of the kinds of products and services and imagination that is going to be the future of the 21st century. All right? Thank you. So,
we have a young person in Kenya who has a question for you. Kenya, you ready? There we go.
Kenya, you ready? There we go. Kenya, you ready?
Indeed. Thank you, South Africa. You are watching us broadcasting to you live from Nairobi here in Kenya's capital. And indeed, I'm joined by 8 young Kenyans who have come in from 5 different counties within the country. Quite excited. I think I speak for all of them when I say that indeed it's an honor to be able to engage with you, Mr. President, well, directly during this program. And I'll just get right to it and give an opportunity for one of the Kenyans who is with me here in studio to be able to ask a question to you, Mr. President. Margaret, you have the floor now.
Thank you, Catherine. Jambo, habari yako, bwana President. We are honored to be with you live today this afternoon from Nairobi, Kenya. Our question to you really is, given the recent shift of trade ties of Kenya to the East, how does this impact on American foreign policy towards Kenya? And does the ICC indictment of our president and his deputy prevent the U.S. from engaging with Kenya both politically and economically? In addition, Mr. President, many Kenyan youth would like to know, what are your thoughts and plans on youth empowerment and the devolved structure of governance to Kenya? Thank you.
Now, Mr. President, as you prepare to respond to that question, I'm sure you're alive to the fact that there has been a lot of speculation in the Kenyan media and also in the social media over your reasons for not visiting Kenya on your second tour of Africa. Maybe if you recall in an interview that you did have with this channel, that is way back on 1st of June 2010, you did promise that during your tenure as president of the United States of America, you will be touring Kenya. Well, will you still keep your word on that?
Well, asante sana. It's wonderful to see all of you. First of all, let me just say that I'm going to be president for another 3.5 years. So, you know, one of the things that you learn as president is not only do people want you to fulfill your promises, but they want you to fulfill your promises yesterday. And you know, part of the reason that I wasn't able to visit Kenya this time is I've been to Kenya multiple times, and there hadn't been a sustained visit by me in West Africa. And then South Africa, given the importance of the work that we're doing together, Tanzania is a country I hadn't visited before, so I was trying to spread the wealth a little bit in terms of my visit. But what's also true, I won't deny, is that Kenya just had an election. I was very proud to see the restraint in which the election was held. We did not see a repeat of the violence that we saw in the last election. But with a new administration that's also having to manage some of the international issues around the ICC, I did not think it was the optimal time for me to visit. But as I said, I've got 3.5 years. So if in 3 years and 7 months I'm not in Kenya, then you can fault me for not following through on my promise. You raised the issue of whether our attitudes towards Kenya changed because of Kenya's orientation towards trade and commerce with the East. And this was asked of me before. It's a general question that I get during this visit. People saying, well, you know, China's here a lot, and, you know, is this what's motivating America to want to be more involved? And I want to make 2 points. First of all, our commitment to Africa is based on our belief in Africa's promise and Africa's future, and we want to be part of that future. Second of all, I think everybody should be involved in Africa. I want China, and I want India, and I want Brazil, and I want Singapore, and everybody, come on now to Africa, because six of the 10 fastest growing economies in the world are right here in Africa. You are seeing a shift inside of Africa in which a commitment to democracy and transparency is beginning to take hold. Yeah, I just visited Senegal, where President Sall has embarked on a reform agenda, including, by the way, shortening his term from 7 years to 5 years, and a belief that, for example, members who join the government need to disclose their assets, just basic measures that can help to root out corruption. And so when you start seeing these changes, everybody should be excited about wanting to do business here in Africa and doing business with Kenya. Now, what I said during a press conference today, I want to repeat, which is I want to make sure that as countries come to Africa, that it's benefiting Africans. So if somebody's building a road here in Africa, make sure they're hiring some Africans. If You know, if there's going to be manufacturing taking place of raw materials, locate some of those plants here in Africa. And so I do want to make sure that whoever you're dealing with, and as you enter into government and business, whoever you're dealing with, making sure that you're getting a good deal that's benefiting the people here and can help to spur on broad-based development. And hopefully that's the kind of relationship that you'll be able to develop with the United States of America. And that's the kind of relationship I want Kenya to have with every country on Earth. We're in a global economy with a global supply chain. And I don't want Africa to continually just be at the bottom of the supply chain. You produce the raw materials, sold cheap, and then all the way up the chain, somebody else is making the money and creating the jobs and the value. So part of what your generation's challenge will be is making sure that, first of all, you have a transparent, accountable, non-corrupt, open government, because economic development is not going to happen in the absence of that kind of certainty. That's what businesses want. They don't want to have to pay a bribe just to get phone lines installed in their business. They don't want to have to hire somebody's cousin just to open a business. And we have to be honest about it. In a lot of countries, that's still the case. And that discourages investment. And then, as you move into positions of power, I want to make sure that you're negotiating a good deal with these other countries. Now, it's got to be realistic. It's got to be based on what assets do you bring to bear. And initially, at least in some countries and in some regions and parts of Africa, you're looking at a certain type of manufacturing or a certain type of industry that may not be very capital intensive, for example, because there may not be as much capital initially to invest. So it may start at a smaller scale, but continually upgrading and improving the prospects for Africa, I think, will require that kind of tough, hard-headed negotiations. But I want every country to be here. Last point. On Kenya, I already made this for all countries. Yes, I want young people to be involved in holding their governments accountable. Now, you know, there is a lot of variety here in Africa in terms of quality of governance. And I don't want to reinforce for the American press that are here this attitude that Africa is just one big, you know, piece of land on the map, right? So there's a lot of variation. Some countries are doing great work when it comes to accountability and democracy and an active civil society and a free press and freedom of assembly. And some countries are not doing as well. But what's exciting right now is you're starting to see more and more a norm, a standard, take hold in Africa. And young people, I think especially, have high expectations about how government should function, and it should function for the public good, not for the benefit of just a few. And people should be able to speak their mind, and they should be able to organize without fear of retribution. And they should be able to cast a ballot without problem. And South Africa, I think, has been a great model. This is one of the greatest legacies of Nelson Mandela, is to show that through a commitment to the Constitution and rule of law and equal treatment for all people, that a country can prosper despite a tragic history. And the same should be true in Kenya, which is why I was heartened that the process of the last election at least did not result in chaos. And that should be true for every country. And President Zuma said something important today at the press conference, and I'm going to see what we can do to work with them. The African Union, I think, is trying to create sort of a peer review system so that it's not just the United States coming in and lecturing some African country that's not observing democracy. It's fellow Africans who are saying, what are you doing? You know, why are you suppressing your people? Why are you throwing political dissidents in jail? Why are you blocking people's ability to organize new political parties? And when peers are organizing in that fashion, then slowly standards get raised and new norms are established. And all of you can be at the forefront of that. So thank you, Kenya. Thank you.
We are going to stay in East Africa and take a question from Kampala, Uganda.
Fantastic. Hello from Kampala in Uganda, the Pearl of Africa, as we're known. I am Nancy Kachungira, a news presenter with NTV Uganda. And Uganda is a very youthful nation. More than half of our population is actually under the age of 15. I'm here today with a group of vibrant and dynamic young people. And as you can see, they are very excited to be addressing President Obama today and asking him a question. Now, I've had the chance to interact with the young people here today, and they're all great young leaders in their own right. And they all have different backgrounds and different experiences. But I've found that one of the things they do have in common is their passion for a better Uganda and for a better Africa. Mr. President, one of them is now going to ask you a question on behalf of the rest of the group.
Hello, Mr. President. It's an honor. My name is Irene Ikomo, and my question comes on behalf of everyone seated here with me. Unfortunately, it's also regarding trade. Mr. President, as young Ugandan leaders, we are looking to the world for equal business partners and commitments and not necessarily aid. We are not looking for donors. And yet, Mr. President, the policy you've just described right now seems to emphasize help coming in from the U.S., but emphasizing offering jobs and employment within the countries that they come into. As young leaders, Mr. President, we want to do the businesses at home and be the ones to own our home markets. So how do you, Mr. President, plan on assisting us in reframing the U.S. policy to achieve this vision?
Well, with respect to U.S. policy, I think you mischaracterize it, because our policy is to see success here in Africa. Now, there's no doubt that U.S. businesses also want to sell into Africa, because as President of the United States, I want to create some jobs in Africa as well. But my attitude is that the more successful African entrepreneurs are, then the more they're going to be purchasing and interested in purchasing U.S. goods. And conversely, when the economy in the United States is doing strong, then we're going to buy more from Africa, and everybody's standards of living can rise. But as you heard me say earlier, I completely agree with you that we want more investment and value creation here in Africa. Now, one thing we haven't spoken about, which I think is critical, is inter-African trade. You know, all too often it's easier to export, say, tea and coffee from East Africa or flowers from East Africa to Europe than it is to export it someplace else in Africa. And part of that is the legacy of colonialism, an orientation out of Africa rather than internal to Africa. Part of it is a lack of basic infrastructure. So port facilities, trains, rail, roads. And so one of the things that we're going to be very interested in is working with the African Union, as well as various regional organizations, to find ways that we can start linking up markets inside of Africa. Because particularly for new businesses, You know, if you're starting a business here in South Africa, then the best chance you have initially for export might be closer to home, one of the surrounding countries. If Uganda, if you have a business that you want to get started, and initially you've gotten your product popular inside of Uganda, the next step, before you think about selling to the United States, you might say to yourself, let me start selling some in Kenya, or let me start selling in Tanzania, or Rwanda. And so part of what we have to do is to find additional ways in which Africans can also trade with each other. Last point I will make, because it's related to trade and capacity building. You know, I just came, as I said, from Senegal. And one of the things that we were featuring was our Feed the Future program and a food security alliance that we're creating here in Africa. And we've already got 9 countries to join, and Senegal just determined that it was going to join as well. But we've already helped 7 million small farmers in Africa to pool their resources, access lower credit, link themselves together as one producer group so that they can market and sell more effectively. And we've seen those farmers increase their yields and their sales by 10, 20, 30, in some cases 50 or 100%. I met with a young woman farmer who had started off with 1 hectare, now has 16. She has been able to achieve enough growth that she's now bought a tractor. She's hired 8 people. Now, that's not what we ordinarily think of as business or entrepreneurship. But if you think about the number of Africans who are involved in agriculture and giving them the tools where suddenly they're getting better prices for their food, their crops, they've got access to a marketplace, they now are getting enough credit to be able to mechanize their operations, and now suddenly they're able to hire some people in their surrounding villages, you've just suddenly seen a small business grow. And the next step may be then they start doing some small food processing. And next thing you know, now they're suddenly supplying these processed foods to a school. And next thing you know, they're supplying those processed foods to the whole country. And so not every business is going to be an internet business, an app. You know, I mean, I know that's where the young people are all, man, I'm just going to create an app. I'm the next Facebook. That's great, and I hope some of you do that. But when we think of development of Africa as a whole, especially if we're thinking about broad-based development, then part of what we have to recognize is that a huge number of people inside of Africa are still in the agricultural sector, and the work that we're doing is trying to create capacity for those small farmers who are essentially small entrepreneurs from being to be successful, because if they've got more money in their pockets, now they can afford to buy your app. All right? So thank you very much for the question, Uganda. Appreciate it.
Mr. President, we're moving over to West Africa now, and we're going to take a question from Lagos, Nigeria.
Well, welcome, Mr. President, to Lagos, Nigeria, home to perhaps Africa's biggest youth population. I'm Maokwe Ogun for Channels Television here. And here with me in the studio are a selection of some of Nigeria's brightest and best. And I must tell you, Mr. President, they're mostly women, so you'd better be careful around them. And they say they're on the march, and they have their question ready. Over now to you, Aisha.
Good afternoon, Mr. President. My name is Aisha Maina, and I represent 7 other people here. In acknowledging our challenges and our responsibility as the young leaders of Nigeria to accept our challenges and make the difference. We would like to thank you for your support to Nigeria and Africa as a whole. The largest resource in Nigeria is our human capital, and we would like to ask a two-pronged question. The first is, how can the United States deepen its investment in deploying technology that would develop our vast human capital as well as the education of her youth? My second question is two-pronged, sorry, Mr. President. Considering how long the war on terror has been on for, would you say that we are winning the war on terror, seeing that there are new terrorist groups developing in Africa, one of which is in Nigeria? Thank you.
Well, those are both great questions. Thank you. And before I answer the question, I just want to be clear. I am surrounded by opinionated women in my house all day long. So I've got good practice dealing with strong women. You guys haven't met Michelle, but you've probably seen her on TV. She's not shy. And Malia and Sasha, they're just taken right up after her. So every night at dinner, I'm surrounded. In terms of human capital and young people, I think there is no doubt that the most important investment any country can make, not just an African country, any country can make, is educating its youth and providing them the skills they need to compete in a highly technological, advanced world economy. Countries that do not do that well will not succeed. Countries that excel at training their young people are going to succeed, because these days businesses can go anywhere. And one of the key criteria for any business is, where can I find outstanding workers? Where can I find outstanding people to manage a plant or manage my sales force? And if you have countries with high illiteracy rates or limited skills, you're going to have problems. And I want to be clear that this is a problem in the United States, not just a problem in Africa. One of the main things that I'm spending a lot of time on is trying to push Congress to improve our early childhood education, because it turns out that children are most susceptible to learning between the ages of 0 and 3. And so working with parents, particularly mothers, around reading to their children, proper nutrition, you know, stimulating activities. Then when they get to school, making sure that our schools are prepared and redesigned for today, because a lot of the schools in the United States were first created during the agricultural era and aren't always appropriate for what's required today. And then on into what we call community colleges, which are two-year colleges or four-year colleges and universities. Somebody should have told my helicopter to quiet down while I'm talking. Yeah, so across the board, we're having to rethink education and workforce training. And one of the things that we want to do is to partner with a country like Nigeria and identify ways that we can provide direct value added, whether it's in helping to train teachers, helping to incorporate technologies into the education process. So, for example, one of the things that you hear across the continent is, because a lot of Africans still live in rural areas, it may be difficult for them to access education and schooling once they get beyond a certain level. Well, are there ways in which we can pipe in, essentially, a university into a rural community? And suddenly you've got the lecturer right there without the same costs or obligation for a young person to take on when they go to travel far away from home in order to study. And so I think that there's some excellent ideas that Sometimes we're doing country by country, depending on the country plan. But this is an area where I would love to get more input from young people in terms of what they think would work. And so part of the Young African Leaders Initiative may be to elicit additional ideas from those, particularly those who may be working in education, and have a sense of what are the barriers right now for young people in order to succeed. Now, with respect to the so-called war on terror, there's no doubt that we've made some progress in dealing with some extremist groups. For example, core al-Qaeda and bin Laden that was based in the Fatah area between Pakistan and Afghanistan, that they have been greatly diminished. But what is also true is that in some ways the problem has metastasized. You have more regional terrorist organizations like a Boko Haram in Nigeria, espousing an extremist ideology, showing no regard for human life, and you know, although they may not have the same transnational capacity that some of the earlier organizations did, they're doing great harm in Africa, and in the Middle East, and in South Asia. You know, people always talk about the terrorist threat to the United States or the West. But the truth of the matter is that the number of people who are killed by terrorist attacks in African countries or in Muslim countries or in South Asia far outstrips any deaths that are experienced by Westerners. It's typically people right there where these organizations are based that are most likely to be killed. When the Kenya embassy bombing happened, the overwhelming majority of people who were killed were Kenyans, not Americans. And so this is not just a problem for us, this is a problem for everybody. Now the question is, you know, how do we address this, this problem? It is my strong belief that terrorism is more likely to emerge and take root where countries are not delivering for their people, and where there are sources of conflict and underlying frustrations that have not been adequately dealt with. The danger we have right now, for example, in a place like Somalia, is that it's been two generations, maybe three, since there was a functioning government inside of Somalia. Now, we've started to see, actually, some progress, in part because of intervention by African nations in Somalia to clear the space, to create the space for governance. But, you know, you look at what's happening in Mali, for example, right now, part of the problem is that you had a weak central government and democratic institutions that weren't reaching out as far into the country as were necessary. And we've got to build those institutions. A lot of what we talked about in terms of responsiveness and governance and democracy, those things become defense mechanisms against terrorism. They're the most important defense against terrorism. So I don't start with the attitude of a military solution to these problems. I think the more that we're giving people opportunity, the more that we're giving people education, the more that we're helping resolve conflicts through regular democratic processes, the less likely they are to take root. Now, having said that, there are some extremist groups that will not compromise or work through a democratic process. And we have to also be realistic about that. And what we want to do is partner with African countries to figure out how we can help, but I promise, this notion somehow that we want to somehow expand our military reach. I was elected to end a war. I've ended one. I'm now in the process of ending another one. Every few weeks, I go and visit soldiers who are your age, who've had their legs blown off in Afghanistan, or worse. Every week, I'm writing letters to the families of fallen soldiers. Sometimes I go to Arlington National Cemetery where our heroes are buried, and I hug those family and I feel their sobs on my shoulder. Now this idea somehow that, you know, we want to get more involved militarily around the world is simply not true. First of all, it costs a lot of money. And the United States, just like every country around the world, has to think about its budget. And where we intervene, oftentimes it's not very effective, because unless you've got a local population that is standing up against terrorism, we end up being viewed as interlopers and intruders. So within the Africa context, what we want to do is to build African capacity. You know, we want the African Union and other regional organizations to build up the capacity to send in peacekeepers, to be able to nip terrorist cells that may be forming before they start and gain strength. And we can provide advice and training and in some cases equipment, but we would love nothing more than for Africa collectively to say no to extremism, say no to terrorism, to say no to sectarianism, which in the case of Boko Haram, for example, is an example of essentially a religious rationale for this kind of violence. And the United States to be able to step back and worry about selling iPads and planes. That's what we would like to do. But what we won't do is just stand by if our embassy is being attacked or our people are in vulnerable situations. And we expect countries to work with us to try to deal with some of these threats. And this is a global issue. It's not just one related to the United States. Okay. All right.
We have time to take one last question from Soweto.
If it's a really short question, I'll give a short answer and we'll get two in. Gentleman right here. Yes, yes, go ahead. Everybody's got a, you got to describe why you're all wearing orange.
Okay, firstly, my name is Hein Dinkelman. I'm nervous. I'm a student at UJ. I'm honors student. Also studied education. You said education people should stand up. My question is, we've got a lot of barriers in this country, and one of those barriers is the amount of students in our classes versus a single person. And what I find it difficult is, how does that one person stand up and control, in some cases, we've just come back from training, some cases 90 to 100 kids in one class. It's difficult enough to carry 40 in my class. How do you carry those 90? I find it very difficult, and try to make an impact in their lives.
Good. I think that's a great question. First of all, I think it's wonderful that you're going into education. Very proud of you. No job more important than educating our young people. This is a challenge that we have in the United States as well, and that is the issue of class size. Now, our problem typically is that our class sizes are around 35 or 33, and we'd like to see if we can get it down in the 20s. If you're talking about 90, that's a whole nother level. Now, I'm assuming we're talking about primary and secondary education. We're not talking about universities, because by the time you get to university, you better be focused on your studies. It's not the job of the teacher to make you do your work and pay attention, because you're now an adult. But when it comes to young people, studies do show that, particularly for poorer children, the more one-on-one attention that they can get from their teachers, the more personalized instruction they can get, the better they're going to do. So the first response is, if you can budget, if a government can budget smaller class sizes, that's better. But not every country is going to have the resources to do that. One of the things that we're starting to see in the United States is how can you effectively use, for example, teachers' assistants in a class who may not be fully certified teachers, but can break up, let's say, a class of 90 into smaller groups. This is also where technology can also potentially make a difference, because it's conceivable that if you've got some sort of technology, a couple of laptops, that you can leverage one teacher into multiple instruction. The question you raise, though, makes me want to suggest to my team when we leave here that we start taking some of the best practices and some of the things that we're learning in the United States and seeing if there may be some application. We might be able to start some pilot programs here in South Africa to see if we can make an impact there. Good. All right. Last question? One more. All right. All these folks have been so patient in the back, I don't want them to feel neglected. So, this gentleman right here, because he seems very eager, right here. Yes, you right there.
Excuse me.
Go ahead. But you guys can feel free to stand together if you want, but okay. I'm only going to take questions from one of them. Okay. What's your name?
My name is Sydney Mukumu. I'm from Limpopo. Thank you. President Obama, I met you in 2006. I was working for the embassy.
Excellent.
Yes. I'm very much worried about some of United States foreign policy, especially on environment. President Obama, today I want you to tell these young leaders about the foreign policy of United States in environment.
On the environment?
Yes, because South Africa is facing the same problem. Whatever is happening in America, it's affecting us. Sure. Please tell this is your children, tell us today.
Yes.
Just like people who are protesting outside, there are people who are crying. And then now you must address them.
Okay,
here,
let's go.
And then tell them outside what is happening. Make it clear, and then when you go back, you'll have a safe trip. Thank you very much, President.
I'm ready. I'll see if I can make it clear. U.S. environmental policy is something that I care deeply about. Some of you know I grew up in Hawaii, one of the most beautiful places on earth, and as a child I was just taught to treasure what the earth gives us and to make sure that we leave it for the next generation. And obviously in a country like South Africa, with incredible beauty and natural resources, that same mentality about conserving the earth and nurturing it to pass on to future generations, I think applies here just as much as it does in the United States. The biggest challenge we have environmentally, and it is an international challenge that we cannot solve alone, is the issue of climate change. There are other issues. Dirty water, dirty air. But the truth is that we've made enormous progress over the last several years, over the last several decades in the United States. And if you come to the United States, environmental quality is pretty good. And internationally, we've promoted policies around, you know, how mercury is released into the environment, and how other poisons are released in the environment, and how businesses have to be held to international standards in terms of worker safety. You know, those are areas where the United States has been at the forefront. We've been in the at the front of the line, not the back of the line, when it comes to those issues. But the existential challenge that we face has to do with a warming planet. And your generation is the one that's going to be most severely affected. Now, the United States and other highly industrialized developed countries over the last 50, 100 years have been pumping up carbon emissions into the atmosphere. And slowly, this has been building up, and it is warming the planet. And we may be reaching a tipping point in which, if we do not solve this problem soon, it will spin out of control and change weather patterns in ways that we can't anticipate, with drought, floods, you know, much more severe natural disasters. And unfortunately, in those situations, it's often poor countries that are affected the most by these changing climate patterns. So I just gave a speech this past week on what the United States is going to do on our next phase of reducing our carbon emissions. The United States actually reduced our carbon emissions more than any other country since I came into office. I just want to make that point. We doubled fuel efficiency standards on cars. We're investing in clean energy like solar and wind. So, and we actually want to share that technology because we think that all countries need to benefit. And part of the opportunity for Africa is to see if we can leapfrog some of the polluting practices of America or Europe and go straight to the clean energy strategies that will allow you to advance economic growth but not corrupt the planet. So we've made progress, but we haven't done enough. And what I did was to say, I challenged the United States. I said, we've got to do more. We're going to start regulating our power plants more efficiently. We're going to make sure that we redouble our efforts to reduce our carbon emissions, and we're setting a goal to meet the agreements that we had both in Copenhagen and in Durban for advanced countries that have a big carbon footprint. But let me make one last point. The United States cannot do it by itself. And the biggest emitter of carbon right now is China. They still have a much lower carbon footprint per person than the United States. But because they have so many people, it's going up rapidly. And Chinese leaders understand this. You know, the same thing that's sending all the carbon into the atmosphere is also making it difficult to breathe in Beijing. So they recognize they've got to come up with a new development model. India is going to have to come up with new development models. Africa, we're going to all have to work together to find ways in which collectively we reduce carbon, but we make sure that there's some differentiation so that countries that are very wealthy are expected to do more, and countries that are still developing, you know, obviously they shouldn't be resigned to poverty simply because you know, the West and Europe and America got there first. That wouldn't be fair. But everybody's going to have to do something. Everybody's going to make some important choices here. And, you know, I expect that it's going to be your generation that helps lead this, because if we don't, it's going to be your generation that suffers the most. Ultimately, if you think about all the youth that everybody's mentioned here in Africa, if everybody's raising living standards to the point where everybody's got a car and everybody's got air conditioning and everybody's got a big house, well, the planet will boil over. unless we find new ways of producing energy. And tomorrow, or the next day when I visit Tanzania, I'm actually going to be going to a power plant to focus on the need for electrification, but the need to do it in an environmentally sound way. So let me just close by saying this. This has been an unbelievable conversation. I had a lot of faith in all of you before I came here. Now I have even more faith in you. You guys are all going to do great things. I'll be retired by the time you do them, and so I'll just sit back and watch, and I'll be proud of you. But what I promise you is that the United States government and the American people are going to want to be your partner for the duration of your careers. And I hope all of you, again, apply for the Young African Leaders Initiative. We want to hear from you about how we can work even more effectively with this great continent because we see a bright future ahead. I hope you've enjoyed it. Thank you, everybody. God bless you. Thank you.
Well, that was U.S. President Barack Obama speaking with a gathering of young people at the University of Johannesburg, Soweto campus. This is VOA's continuing coverage of the president's trip to Africa. I am Vincent McCorry. Joining me once again to discuss the president's trip and today's town hall is Emira Woods, co-director Foreign Policy in Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies here in Washington. Emira. That was quite something at that town hall. Tell me, the president talked about a whole lot of things. This young, vibrant fellows asked all types of questions. What is your takeaway from this?
My takeaway, you know, President Obama is great at making speeches. The rhetoric is phenomenal. But the reality has been far from what has been conveyed in the speeches. This is the problem. So when the president talks about creating a Washington Fellowship, we all applaud that. But we recognize that at this moment in Congress, there is an immigration reform bill that could very well jeopardize the opportunities for Africans in particular. To have a possibility to come to this country, to study, to be able to work, to do all that is possible. So you could actually reduce the number of Africans that are able to come to the U.S. in this immigration reform without the administration actually using its political capital to assure that there isn't just a nice fellowship program, but that there is a structural, fundamental way in which people are able to have a path to be able to come to the U.S., go back to their countries, do as they choose in terms of determining their future. Mm-hmm. I think clearly on the question of trade, again, great rhetoric. Reality, far from
that. You got the sense that actually these young fellows have very well versed with what's happening and the challenges ahead, especially the question on AGOA 2015.
Absolutely.
And also how Africa can add value and benefit from all these great programs.
Again, the president talked beautifully about a woman farmer and being an entrepreneur, and all of that is welcome. But the reality is it's called the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act, but the real opportunities from that trade have come primarily to big oil companies. It is the big oil, gas, and mining companies that have benefited from AGOA. And unless there is a fundamental change, you know, we talk about free trade, but it's far from free. This is the problem. There is an imbalance, and it has caused really much more harm to African countries than good. And of course, the third point on the terrorism. Again, we could talk about the difference between the rhetoric and the reality.
That's quite a lot to talk about.
Without a doubt.
Let's go back to where it's all been happening in South Africa. Now, VOA senior White House correspondent Dan Robinson has been traveling with the president and joins us now from Johannesburg. Dan, this was quite a town hall. Those questions were not staged, I presume. They were not pre-screened. How do you characterize this segment of the president's trip to Africa?
Well, he has to be greatly satisfied and energized by this kind of a performance by the people who asked him questions. This is classic Barack Obama. You've seen him do this in other locations around the world, most recently, for example, in Israel, where he talked to Israeli youth, where he basically tries to reach over, you know, as he puts it, the leaders of countries and appeal directly to young people that he says are the key to their own futures. And in this case, I mean, it's hard to even read down. I wouldn't be looking in the camera if I tried to summarize all of this. But you know, I agree with your commentator there that there's a big difference between rhetoric and reality. And this kind of program, such as the Young African Leaders Initiative, he wants to transform into an exchange program. You know, the question is how these programs, not only how they get started and how they're continued.
And in fact, I mean, you've been close to those events, especially the meetings with the African leaders. You get the sense that the young people are not intimidated. They are willing to ask the tough questions and right on the face of the president.
Right, exactly. You heard that in the last question from, I can't remember where that was from, if you can help me there, but on the environment.
That was from South Africa,
From South Africa,
yeah.
Where, you know, the very, with a lot of humor involved there, asked the question, and it gave Mr. Obama the opportunity to go into his major climate change proposal. But, I mean, that faces some big obstacles back in Washington and Capitol Hill, and everyone knows that.
Well, thanks a lot, Dan. And I know you have a long evening, long night, and a long day tomorrow. Viewers, Daniel Robinson reporting from Johannesburg. We thank you very much for joining us. Now, want to join? Be joined now by viewers Anita Powell, also reporting from Johannesburg. Anita, welcome. Okay, we will join Anita a little later, but let me stay right here in the studio for a minute. Well, talking about that young man who asked that question about the environment. First, as Dan put it, you know, these are young fellows who are not just addressing issues that affect the youth, but actually these are issues that affect the countries. And you would feel like they represent the countries better than the leaders themselves. I never hear the African leaders talk about these issues with that kind of openness and passion.
Well, that is the dynamism of young people, wherever they are. We've seen them in the streets of Tunisia and in Egypt and really throughout the continent. It is young people that have changed the world. You know, we talk about, you know, Nelson Mandela, but, you know, Martin Luther King. It's a long history of young people taking leadership in their own hands and changing the course of history. So clearly, young people are concerned about a range of issues, but most importantly, the future of this planet. You know, can the planet survive for their generation and the generations to come? And I think the concern is that the U.S. and much of the world has to get it right. You have South Africa already facing the impact of rising sea levels, you know, as is Dakar, where the president just left. You already see the impact of climate change and global warming in Africa. And to what extent the U.S. can really play a serious role.
The president said they've done quite a bit so far.
But there's a lot more to do in terms of mitigating the impacts of climate change, particularly in Africa, where you're already seeing the dramatic impacts throughout the continent.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, the young people, we have to applaud them because they have shed light on what is really critical for
and,
now and into the future.
The question from Nigeria on terrorism, the young fellows there saying, you know, the U.S. Hasn't done as much as they think it should have done. But really, in all fairness, how much more can the U.S. do to stem the threat of terrorism, not only in West Africa, but also even in East Africa?
Well, I think the problem is that on this frame of the so-called war on terror, the U.S. may actually be creating more extremists than they're trying to take out. Well, if you think about, for example, Al-Shabaab in Somalia, Al-Shabaab started after U.S. aerial assaults on Somalia back in 2006, were a reaction to a militarized U.S. foreign policy. So the question is, if the U.S. is moving in a direction of more militarization, we see, for example, this recently announced drone base being established in Niger. To what extent are you creating more anti-American sentiment? Creating, again, more fodder for the extremists who see American militarization as part of the problem. If we look at, for example, the crisis in Mali, many recognize that the crisis in Mali happened for two reasons. First, the flood of weapons from U.S. NATO into Libya. Those weapons, together with Gaddafi's caches, made their way across the borders into Mali. And that's coupled with U.S. trained, you know, Malian soldiers who launch the coup.
It's a tricky situation,
creating chaos
because
in
America wants to help. To help on the ground, you need either boots or at least you need weapons
But how do you address the root causes of the crises? You look at helping to rebuild economies in ways that they meet the needs of all the people of the society. Mm-hmm. It is building healthy societies,
and now,
good, decent jobs,
let's take it,
healthcare, housing. That will
bring stability and
security.
The president said, for example, Africa doesn't need to remain on the lowest rank of the food chain. Where is the role of the African leaders? I mean, must African leaders just be waiting to be given, to be told what to do, be waiting for the U.S. policy, or should they be proactive and, weave out policies that are beneficial to their people?
Well, as the world's attention is with the Mandela family, I think Mandela is a wonderful reminder. Africa has had visionary leaders. It's Mandela, but it's also Patrice Lumumba, many others who sought the interests of their country, put the needs of their people first. You know, often those leaders were not given a space. Lumumba was assassinated, probably the most extreme case, right? And Mobutu put in his place there in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, then called Zaire, and kept in place for 38 years. So Africa has had those leaders. I suspect many of those leaders are among the young generation that we saw today and we see all around the continent. But they need to be given space and a voice. Civil society needs to be strengthened in a way that leadership can take hold for future generations.
Those are kind of an idealism, especially in the early 60s or late 50s to early 60s. The first African leaders post-independence were actually young people, the Nyereres, the Nkrumahs, and all that.
Yes.
And something happened after they took over leadership. Now, do you think the leaders of today, the young leaders of today, are in a different place, that they're not likely to turn into their former leaders when they become leaders themselves tomorrow?
Well, what we see, you see Egypt, it is young people taking to the streets to demand a different political process, to demand an economy that works for all. The president just left Senegal. Clearly, it was young people in Senegal that said no to any efforts to really undermine democracy. Democracy that had been, in Senegal since the late 1800s, right?
Would you say there are more, the youth of today, playing a more critical role in the transformation of their societies than the youth of some time back, say in the 80s, 70s, going back?
Well, I think we had a period where visionary leaders were being marginalized to the extent that their voices, their vision was not really upheld. And now I think because of the experience of Tunisia, of Egypt, of all of these, some say the Occupy movements, but throughout the world, young people, together with opposition leaders, trade union leaders, and a range of other civil society actors, they are taking to the streets, they are taking also to the suites to demand a different way. And ultimately, it is that vision, that energy, that dynamism that will transform Africa and truly the entire world.
Yes. Let me just go back to the president, president's town hall question from Kenya. Mm. What did you make of that? First, he made a commitment that he will visit if Kenya holds a peaceful election, and he was challenged to live up to his promise. Now, he says, got 3 years and 7 months or so. What do you make of that?
I suspect Kenyans are going to keep an eye on this question and make sure that is a promise that this president keeps in this second term. I don't think that, I think it'll be difficult to ignore Kenya. And so I think the call is that this trip to Africa be followed in not too long a time frame, by another trip. I mean, let's recognize that, really the president has been to just a handful of countries in his both first and second term. And you have 54 countries, including Kenya, all of which are clamoring for a different relationship with the United States.
Yes.
And so, hopefully there will be another trip in the second term.
Yeah, and people keep counting the number of countries. For sure, a U.S. president is not going to visit all the countries of Africa in two terms. So is it important how many numbers the president of countries the president visits, or is the kind of message it takes to a region when, for example, he goes to West Africa or Southern Africa?
Well, yeah, people are making comparisons to China. You know, the head of state in China has traveled to 30 African countries in the last 5 years. And those comparisons can be made. But I think clearly the issue is, you know, to what extent a commitment can be made to keep Africa at the top of the policy agenda for the United States, okay. Not just a visit that's, you know, that's then and the pages turn to yet another issue or yet another region, but how to have sustained and really proactive engagement from the highest level in the United States so that U.S.-Africa policy can be turned in as constructive a direction as possible.
Thank you. Now let's try to go down to Johannesburg. Anita Powell is joining us on the phone line. Anita, welcome to the
program. Sani Bonani. How are you guys?
We are very fine. Yeah. We have had a good time here listening in to the town hall there in Soweto. Tell me first, you know, the young person who asked the question on environment reminded the president that outside of that hall, there have been demonstrations. Tell us about all these demonstrations on the streets of South African towns.
Well, so there were about 100 demonstrators earlier this morning across the street from the University of Johannesburg Soweto campus. And they were mostly trade unionists, communists, socialists, and members of a Muslim association. And the grievances are all things we've heard before. Some people criticized President Obama's foreign policy. Some had issue with his use of drones. Some had issues with the failure to close Guantanamo Bay. And still others said that he just hadn't kept true to any of his promises. So it was nothing that we haven't heard before, but it was quite a lively protest, and there was apparently a scuffle, but nobody was really hurt.
Yes, but from what you might have heard from other young fellows perhaps who listened in or who are anticipating this town hall, do they make a big deal of it?
Well, let me just refer you to the Twitterverse, which is now head over heels in love with President Obama. People in South Africa are rhapsodizing over his performance. So I think that these protesters represented a small minority, an important group, because this is a democracy and people are free to express their opinions. But I think the takeaway here is that he knocked it out of the park as far as most South Africans are concerned.
And very briefly, knowing that the country has been having this somber mood hanging over it because of Nelson Mandela's situation, would you say that nevertheless there was that warm welcome, the enthusiasm and excitement that would be expected when the U.S. president visits a place?
Definitely. I mean, there's definitely been a pall over the visit, and I think the president, President Obama, has shown this by being somewhat restrained. But what's also interesting, referring to Twitter, which is now our new mode of communication for these media events, it's interesting that nobody really mentioned Mandela for the hour that the president spoke. He was pretty much off the Twitterverse for an hour, which is really something. So I think we could say that President Obama was a little ray of sunshine through the clouds for many South Africans.
Well, Anita, thank you very much for joining us. Anita Powell joining us there from South Africa in Johannesburg. Now, viewers, Anne Luke covered President Obama's visit to Senegal earlier this week. She joins us now from Dakar. How are you, Anne?
Hi, Vincent.
Hi. Now, I believe you were watching and listening into the president's town hall in South Africa. What did you make of it, talking to these young fellows?
No, we weren't actually able to stream it here in Senegal.
Okay.
But,
Then don't worry about that. Now, tell me, in South Africa, we saw all these demonstrations, but in Dakar, before the president left, one of the things he did is actually met farmers there. He talked about America's help to farmers and also to African countries, and specifically Senegal, to help fight hunger and malnutrition. Tell me how Senegal responded to this kind of visit of the president and also the help that it has received.
Yeah, aid is definitely a key sector in which the U.S. is very visible in Senegal. Overall, Senegalese responded really well to the president's visit. I mean, it was an honor. You know, although they don't really see much change for their day-to-day life. The biggest takeaway, I think, for people in Senegal, people perhaps on the continent, were the comments about gay rights that were made at that press conference. I mean, they dominated all headlines in Senegal after his visit. Basically, the president calling on us to respect That everyone should have equal rights before the law, and President Macky Sall coming back and saying that Senegal's not ready to consider decriminalizing homosexuality here. He got major kudos from the Senegalese for what they saw as standing up to Western pressure to accept homosexuality.
Yeah, that was really very, very remarkable there. But also, President Macky Sall said, he asked President Obama for more help in fighting terrorism. Now, we know that Senegal borders Mali, has a long border that they share there. What kind of challenges Senegal actually faced so far? Has there been any threat to the Senegalese border there?
No, they've stopped a few fighters that were presumably headed to Mali to rejoin the jihadist groups there. But other than that, it's been more just an effort at controlling those borders, trying to keep the threat out of Senegal. People make a lot of Senegal's, peaceful Sufi Islam as being kind of an antidote to this kind of extremism. But there is some concern that perhaps there's some creeping reformism here, and that there could be a slight bit of, a small minority of sympathy for this kind of a movement.
Yes, and the president also kind of addressed other countries in the region just before he left. He mentioned progress in democracy in some of the neighboring countries. What are you hearing? Some of those countries, what have they done right?
For example, he mentioned Sierra Leone, and I was in Senegal for the election here. I was in Sierra Leone for their election as well in 2012, and I saw very similar things happening. This very grassroots youth, big push from the youth to monitor the election themselves. I mean, in Sierra Leone, they had an individual in each polling station, literally by text message, just sending in results, sending in reports of how things were going. That's what happened in Senegal as well, and I think those kind of activities are the kind of thing that he was highlighting.
I saw such a contrast between South Africa, the reception in South Africa and in Senegal. While there was a lot of excitement and enthusiasm in South Africa, but there was also all these demonstrations way before the president arrived. How were the streets of Senegal before arrival and during his visit?
People were happy to see him. He was welcomed. He was welcomed pretty in a pretty enthusiastic fashion downtown on Thursday when he went to the palace. But other than that, I mean, life was pretty much as normal. We didn't see any protests or any real negativity surrounding his visit, other than perhaps a little annoyance at the security measures.
Right. Well, thanks a lot, Anne. And you've been very busy there. Anne Loke in Senegal. Joined us from the city of Dakar. Now, the next stop on the president's week-long Africa tour is Tanzania. Joining us now with a preview is VOA's East Africa correspondent, Gabe Joslow, who joins us from Dar es Salaam. Hello, Gabe.
Hi, Vincent. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for waiting a lot, and I know it's very hot in Dar es Salaam. First, share with us, how is the mood there? How are people behaving on the streets of Dar es Salaam?
Well, if you know Dar es Salaam at all, you'll know it's a pretty laid-back place. As much as it's a big city that's developing pretty rapidly, things are going about here at sort of a normal pace. You're not seeing too much, overt excitement about the president's visit. You are seeing, more of a security presence on the street. You're seeing just the police out on every corner. And people will say that they're excited, but it's a low-key affair at this point.
Very interesting. And we know that the president in South Africa mentioned that when he comes to Tanzania, one of the places he's going to visit is this electric or rather energy plant in a place called Ubungo in Dar es Salaam. But also Tanzania officials remind us that actually Tanzania is one of the largest beneficiaries of aid from the United States, especially through the Millennium Challenge Corporation. So generally in the East Africa region, would you say that Tanzania comes off as a country that has a more favorable relationship with the U.S. than the rest?
Well, as you mentioned, yeah, actually Tanzania is the largest recipient of aid from the Millennium Challenge Corporation. There's a compact for about $700 million that goes to a variety of infrastructure and road projects around the country. Also, Tanzania is going to benefit from the new Feed the Future initiative that President Obama announced previously, which is going to help to develop agricultural technology and the likes across the country. So I would say that Tanzania has been a major focus of U.S. foreign aid and investment. And one of the reasons is that it's just such a stable country. There really hasn't been any open conflict or any real serious instability in many years here. And so I think it's seen as a trustworthy and reliable partner.
You know, you live in Kenya, and not long ago you did a piece on how Kenyans reacted to President Obama skipping their country. I guess people in Tanzania are like telling Kenyans, hey, we are the good boys in this region. But really, Kenyans do understand why the president wouldn't visit there, but they still felt very disappointed, would you say?
I would say that there was some disappointment on the streets of Kenya for sure, and certainly around President Obama's ancestral home in the West. And I thought it was really interesting that during his town hall, he did address very strictly the ICC charges against Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta and his deputy do create a kind of difficult situation for the U.S. and for relations, saying that, you know, he appreciated that there was no violence during the election, but given the current political situation, it just didn't make sense to visit Kenya on this trip. And it was good to hear the president be so blunt. We'd heard similar comments from his administration, but I don't think we'd heard anything directly from his mouth before.
Great. Thanks a lot, Gabe. Gabe Joslow in Tanzania. Thanks a lot for chatting with us, and I know you're going to be busy in
Thank the
you. Coming days. Yeah. Now, for complete coverage of President Obama's trip to Africa, be sure to listen to Nightline Africa, Daybreak Africa, and Africa News Tonight on VOA Radio. You can also watch VOA's Africa 54 and get the latest news anytime at thevoanews.com. I'm Vincent McCorry. Thank you very much for joining us. We now join our regularly scheduled program, Already in Progress. Thank you.